Today, I have another fantastic speaker, author, and expert gardener with us on the line. His name is Robert Nold, and he is an incredibly engaged gardener. He pays attention to all of the finer points of what's going on. He researches, he learns firsthand, and he has written books about his experiences. I would definitely consider Bob Nold to be cutting edge, and I think you'll really enjoy him. I got to know Bob through his book called High and Dry, Gardening with Cold Hardy Dryland Plants. And this book blew me away, I have to admit. The introduction really does what I was just describing the winter segment of this series is meant to do, just to all kind of get us on the same page and lay it out. What are we really doing here? What are we dealing with? And one of the many things in Bob's introduction that struck me was when he said, in the beginning of the introduction even, he said, "I see my purpose here as being to ease the pain of gardening and direct gardeners to more amenable and suitable plants so that going out into the garden is as much of a dream as it is anywhere else on earth." Doesn't that sound great? So that's what Bob's going to help us with here today. He's probably not going to focus so much on the plants themselves because we'll be doing that more with other speakers in the summer segment. But Bob will be talking to us about soil and establishing plants and other great stuff. So, Bob, welcome to the call today. How are you doing?
Thanks. Pretty good.
Good. So, as I've done with other speakers so far, I would love to just help introduce you to our audience in a kind of general way that will help us all relate to you by asking you to tell us how you got started gardening in the first place and where was that?
I learned to garden from my grandfather who lived in Los Angeles. And I was hooked at a really early age, probably about 6 years old. That was back in the 50s. And ever since then, I've become kind of obsessed with gardens. And they've always seemed to me to be sort of a place of refuge from the pain of life, you know, the having to work for a living, having all these other things happen. You can go out in the garden and there you are in this nice, peaceful place. So when I came to Colorado, my neighbor across the street was a gardener, and she was growing red hot pokers and columbines and bleeding hearts. I'd never seen those plants before. And so as soon as I saw those, I wanted to grow them in my parents' garden. And I had a garden there till I went to college, and then kind of stopped until I got married, and then I started gardening up again like a crazy person. Then we moved here in 1985, and I started gardening, and things weren't working the way I hoped they would. Plants would die left and right, and I was really frustrated. I mean, I was spending hundreds of dollars on plants that were dead the next year. Well, about that time, local garden writers were writing about xeriscape, and there was a garden at Denver Botanic Gardens called the at that time it was called the Xeriscape Demonstration Garden, that had all these native plants that were growing without any water at all. And I thought the plants were cool. That's the most important thing, is I was really drawn to the plants. But the fact that these plants would grow with the natural rainfall was like a revelation to me, that I could actually have a garden and not have to run out with the hose every 5 minutes, and I could have plants in flower and doing their own thing without me having to sit there and worry that these things were, that I've spent all this money on, were going to die. And I basically continued that for the last almost 30 years.
I think that's amazing, and I think that's what so many of us are after, and I think that you really echoed the experience of a lot of us out here who have tried all these things and they haven't worked and want to find out what you've learned, how to do that, how to make it easier and not use all kinds of supplemental water. So that's great.
The hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of dead plants are a legacy to my initial frustration that trying things that are just totally inappropriate here, even though they may be cold hardy, they don't do well for other reasons. It's too windy, it's too sunny, the soil is too alkaline, the soil is too clayey, you name it. There's not enough humidity. A lot of plants like humidity. A lot of plants that are commonly grown back east need humidity to survive.
Mm-hmm. And some of those are the same plants that a lot of us are trying to grow out here without much success, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And I will add that I do grow some rhododendrons because I feel like it, but they're in a little tiny area of the garden that I pay a great deal of attention to, and it's not even the size of the rug in the kitchen here. So it's a little tiny, tiny garden, and my success rate with those is not very high. So I come into that part of gardening with no high hopes. And
it's
not a kind of gardening that I would recommend to anybody else.
But you must love it to keep doing it.
Well, I kind of like them, but my main interest is unusual selections of native plants. I want to be surrounded by native plants because I just like the look of them.
Mm-hmm. So before we keep going with all these great ideas you're throwing out there, I want to just back up a second and ask you to tell the audience what your elevation is and what the soil is like where you're gardening.
It's 5,600 feet. The soil in the neighborhood is creek bottom loam that you can dig in with your fingers when it's slightly moist. But when the houses were built, they scraped away a lot of that soil all around the houses and trucked in this horrible clay subsoil that's filled with rocks that has alkalinity in it, because you can see in the neighborhood places where the silver maples are planted in that subsoil, and they are bright yellow chlorotic all the time, the ones that are planted in the native creek bottom soil are green.
Mm-hmm.
So that creek bottom soil is like dream soil for gardeners who take all their ideas from Eastern gardening. The alkaline clay soil is just, it's just horrible.
But you've learned how to work with it.
Initially, I used an army entrenching tool that was from my father, and I would scrape away a little bit of the soil, maybe a couple inches, and then pour water in there and let it pool down and soak down a couple inches, and then scrape away more and so forth, and pry out all the huge rocks. And it was pretty unpleasant. It was like more like a trial than gardening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I tried to learn a lesson from real life. One day I was digging down by about halfway between here and Colorado Springs, I was digging around, because that was my job, digging holes at the time, and I was digging in some native Gambles oaks, and I noticed how terrible the soil was. And I thought, well, if these plants are growing in this terrible soil, quote-unquote terrible soil, then maybe that's the sort of plant that I should be growing here instead of trying to grow rhododendrons in my front yard or what else? I was just growing all sorts of things that were totally inappropriate and are totally gone now because they were sitting in basically a little bowl of concrete.
Mm-hmm.
So I just decided to plant native plants in this awful soil.
And did they work?
They worked pretty well. It takes a long, long time for plants to get their roots into soil that is this terrible. Because generally speaking, dry land plants need a highly oxygenated soil. And clay soil is comprised of these little tiny particles that are basically glued together. And so when you plant a plant there, it takes forever for those roots to grow into that soil. So you have to be patient
mm-hmm.
when you plant these plants. But in the long run, you have a plant that is far hardier because its roots have grown into this soil so they're so firmly entrenched in this soil that you couldn't dig them up for anything.
Mm-hmm. And those are native plants that naturally grow in that type of soil, or they also are plants that normally wouldn't find themselves in that clay soil?
It's either or, and a lot of people question the idea of growing plants in this awful soil
mm-hmm.
because so many of them come from oxygenated soils. But if you're not watering, then you're not driving that oxygen out of the clay soil. And the number of times that it's rained here or snowed where the oxygen is actually driven out of the soil are probably zero, because you would know that right away, because the symptoms of no oxygen in the soil are plant death.
Uh-huh.
They have to have that oxygen. The roots themselves start working into the soil and make it much more friable.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I did was I double dug the soil in the front yard after I decided not to add any amendments or anything like that, did that double digging, which is a huge amount of work, but it breaks up that clay over the wintertime. The action of the frost makes that soil much more friable.
So you do that in the fall?
You do that in the fall. It's a one-time deal. You do that in the fall, double dig, one spade depth, and then another spade depth after that, and then you just leave that area fallow over the winter time, and the freezing and thawing really does a number on that soil.
Mm-hmm.
I think nowadays I would recommend incorporating large amounts of different sized pieces of gravel into the garden. Make a mixture of about 60% gravel and 40% clay.
Really?
And
not much, it does.
Yeah. That's because I think a lot of people are not very patient. I mean, I originally wanted this instant garden. I wanted everything, plant it 1 week and the next week everything be huge and in flower. And it's taken about 25 years for the shrubs to mature and the perennials that survived to mature and start seeding around, because the soil was so horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you need a pick to garden in, you have a problem.
Yeah, it can be rather difficult.
The thing about adding organic matter, which I did initially, was that that's also a one-time thing. You can't dig up the plant and add more organic matter. And at Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, I watched this program where they have the interns there lift all the perennials, one-third of the perennials from the perennial border every year and replace the soil. Well, that's what you need to do if you're adding organic matter. And some of these native plants have roots that go down 6 feet. Mm. So how are you going to do that?
Yeah, not very
easily. The other alternative is...
If you ever want your plants to get established, right?
They
can't get established ever if you keep lifting them.
They'll die.
Right.
But the other problem that you have is that when you buy a potted plant, it's in some sort of soilless mix. The garden soil is of an entirely different texture, almost always of an entirely different texture. And so when you put those plants in the ground, you have two different textures. One, your garden soil that plant roots are going to take a long time to get through, and the soilless mix that plant roots can move through easily. And roots will always take the route of least hindrance. So they'll just keep growing round and round and round in that soilless mix.
So it's like they're in a pot.
They are in a pot.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing that is critical to gardening in horrible soil is to get rid of that soilless mix.
And how
put
do you do
those
that?
Roots in contact with the soil. There's a couple of ways. One is to just set them in a dish pan and just kind of jiggle the plant and wash that mix off that way. But I found that the easiest way is to plant the plant like normal, and then take a watering can or a hose and just water it, wash that stuff off of there. And maybe 3 gallons with a watering can will usually wash most of that organic stuff out of there, and then you can backfill with the native soil. Because establishing for a plant means that the roots are growing in the surrounding garden soil. So if you've already gotten the plant into the surrounding garden soil that way, you've got to jump on establishing them.
Mm-hmm. So when you say plant it like normal, do you mean you dig the hole, you put the plant in there with the soil from the nursery, and then before you backfill, you rinse it off, and then are you removing that soil from the hole, or are you leaving that in there, and does that create another interface that's ultimately difficult for the roots?
Well, when you direct a stream of water at that peat, perlite, vermiculite stuff, it generally just tends to fly all over the place.
Mm.
And I just backfill it. I'm kind of a slob that way.
It is
a really good way to plant anything in hot weather.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just dig this hole and then water the plant. I like a watering can the best. Dig the hole, water the plant, let the water drain out, and then just keep doing that maybe 3 times. But as you hit the soilless mix with the stream of water coming from the watering can, that stuff is going to fly all over the place. And this is not like a gentle operation. You do both at once. You're watering the plant and at the same time dispersing that soilless mix with the stream of water.
Mm-hmm. Now
pretty well.
Good. Okay. I have to ask you, I wonder how many listeners right now are kind of smirking a little bit like I am, thinking about doing this process and thinking about the test they tell you to do sometimes about digging a hole to see how fast your soil drains. And when I've done that, sometimes it's taken hours for that water in that hole to be absorbed. So doing what you're recommending three times, that's like a whole day or two long project for some of us.
Well, we're talking about small plants
okay.
here. We're talking about small plants. And if you're using the regular native soil
mm-hmm.
and you haven't double dug it beforehand, mm-hmm. well, then, yeah, you're going to be gardening in, gardening on a brick, basically.
Yeah.
But that's one of the first things that I did when I first moved here was I read all this stuff about, well, you dig a hole and you pour water in, and if it takes like 20 minutes, it's quote-unquote well-drained
mm-hmm.
soil, and if it takes like such and such, you know. But one native plant nursery in California says 2 hours and the soil is well-drained.
Wow.
So, see, there's a difference there. Now we're being told something different,
mm-hmm.
that soil, that if you dig a hole and the water goes through, boom, like that, that's too fast. And if 2 hours is well-drained, then all day is... And some places in my yard, it still does take hours for water to drain away because it's sitting in that subsoil.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sits there and sits there and sits there. But eventually it does drain away. It takes clay soil longer to absorb water than other types of soil.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it generally goes horizontally first rather than vertically. And so it takes longer for that horizontal layer to absorb the moisture.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up because I'm starting to realize that maybe my own problem, and again, I bet a lot of others out there can relate to this, has been that I haven't done the double digging first in my clay soil because I haven't had as much success with my plants as I would have liked to. And so, to be perfectly honest, after reading your book and feeling like I saw the light and everything for the last 3 years or so, last summer I thought, you know what, I don't think this is working, and I'm just going to water every day during the heat of the summer and hope that my plants will bloom more and will thrive more. And I have to say, I don't think that they did. I just worked a lot harder, and I think most of the water did exactly what you're saying. It just went horizontally. I don't think it really even got to the roots of the plant, which is very discouraging.
Well, I think that you would probably find that if you got rid of that soilless mix, and I have to say that this is just a generalization. Every garden is slightly different. But if you got rid of that soilless mix to begin with, that you would find the plants are happier in the long run, though you can't expect instant gratification.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, unless everybody gets plants for free, you're probably going to be saving money in the long run.
Yes.
Which I've killed more plants than anybody else, probably in North America. And I used to have a stack of them in the backyard that was the largest man-made object in Jefferson County. It was a huge stack of plants. And almost every one of them, when I pulled them out of the ground, they came right out with their root ball. Just like the day that they were planted, before I started washing the stuff off. The other important thing is to loosen the roots. because if you don't do that, the roots have already started in one direction, and if they're going around in the pot, they will keep going that way because it's the path of least resistance.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There are some exceptions to plants like this, like astragalus and other members of the pea family really resent having their roots loosened. But you learn by trial and error.
Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of loose ends I'm wanting to go back to from things that you put out there. One of them I want to ask is about the double digging as it relates to soil structure, because I know there's a school of thought out there that the soil, the natural stratification of the soil is really important to maintain that integrity. Obviously, in your personal situation where soil was transported and dumped there, it's not so relevant. But for those of us who have undisturbed native soil, are we messing up things with the natural order of microbes and whatever that we might want to maintain the integrity of by double digging?
I'm glad you asked that question.
Oh, good.
We don't care about microbes.
Oh, okay.
What we care about is mycorrhizae.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, I have to back up a little bit and say that a lot of this has come to light since I wrote the book. And what has happened is that in restoration projects where they're restoring large areas of disturbed ground, let's say overgrazing or whatever, or where they, where the areas become infested with weeds and they got rid of the weeds, is that a lot of native plants, a lot of plants, period, have a symbiotic relationship with a fungus that lives within the cell walls of the roots. And this fungus allows the plant to absorb more nutrients, pulls water from farther down in the ground. In other words, the roots don't search for water. The roots that are infected with this fungus, pull the water from lower down in the ground, and it makes the plant more drought tolerant. These mycorrhizae are present in almost every soil, and that's what we care about if we're going to do less or no watering, because it's a natural relationship between these plants and the fungus and the soil. So I don't know whether or not double digging disturbs this network. It's called the hyphal network, H-Y-P-H-A-L, the hyphal network of fungus. But my plants are doing just fine in this soil. And to a dry land gardener, that's the definition of healthy soil, that you have this mycorrhizal relationship.
So how do we get that, nurture it, make sure we have it? You say it's what we need to care about. Well, what does that caring look like? Or is it something we might want to go purchase somewhere and introduce?
The jury is still out on whether or not buying mycorrhizae is of benefit, but I would say offhand that it can do no harm, because studies have shown that a large number of plants are not specific as far as their choice of fungus. They will work with any fungus, but one of the things that you can do to encourage this is not fertilize.
Good. That was another question.
They did studies, And a lot of these are available on places like Google Scholar, and you have to, some of them you have to buy, but the ones from universities you can download. They did studies of little and big bluestem, both of which are strongly mycorrhizal grasses. And the ones that were inoculated with the mycorrhizae grew three times faster, were more drought resistant, and generally healthier than the ones that were also inoculated but were fertilized. There's a site online that you can find that shows also that there's only a small window of allowable phosphorus, relatively small window of allowable phosphorus that allows the mycorrhizae to survive. So really you are working against your plants by fertilizing them. Now, this is not true of all plants. Buffalo grass and blue gram are very weakly mycorrhizal, and so they respond to fertilizer by growing better. Fungicides, obviously, are a no-no because the mycorrhizae is a fungus.
Mm-hmm. So
I think that's basically it in a nutshell as far as that natural healthy soil perspective from somebody like me.
Uh-huh.
It just kind of worked out that way in the front yard that the lack of fertilizer was a benefit. And I just read this online and I thought, wow, I've been doing the right thing all along and didn't even know it.
Well, isn't there another aspect about fertilizing as far as it, our clay soils are quite rich in nutrients, and if we treat them the right way and grow plants that are happy in them, should we still need fertilizer for those plants?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. If you have your soil tested and it turns out that you have less nitrogen than you need, then you grow a crop of snow peas. So that's a natural alternative to adding nitrogen to the soil, because the snow peas will fix nitrogen in the soil, and there you have your nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So the native plants don't really, as far as I know, really don't care so much about nitrogen as they do about an excess of phosphorus. And unfortunately, a lot of homes where there were existing lawns have a lot of phosphorus in them because of lawn fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how one overcomes that. Now, it doesn't really damage the plants to fertilize and water and things like that, but then you lose that fungal relationship. And so the plants become, you might say, addicted to water and fertilizer.
Because they're not getting the mycorrhizae. And so instead,
right,
they become dependent on these external sources, basically.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course, that's not necessarily in itself a bad thing, but it just means that the plants are going to become more dependent on water than they would ordinarily. Last year, from middle of July until December 31st, we had less than 7/10 of an inch of precipitation here. And yet the native oaks and everything else looked fine. There was no sign at all of drought stress. And the only reason that I can attribute this to is the fact that the plants have this fungal relationship. Aside from the natural structure of the plants that allows them to withstand drought, like cacti store water in their leaves or in their stems, and so forth. It's not magic. There has to be a reason for this, and it's the reliance of the plants on this fungus. And the native oaks are particularly reliant on mycorrhizal associations for drought resistance. They will go through a year with 1 inch of precipitation, like we saw in 2002, and look like they're just fine. And it's not because somebody is sneaking out and watering them or anything. It's because of the fact that the plants are adapted to endure this through that fungal relationship.
So if folks want to try to make sure that they do have that in their soil, the mycorrhizae, would you recommend adding it in, like, let's say someone has a whole new bed they're creating and they want to double dig it, would they add it then, or would they add it just per plant when in the hole when they're planting?
I've been told that, with the exception of mine spoils, most soils in Colorado are teeming with mycorrhizae. Once you plant one plant, the plant will attract that fungus, and then other plants will start attracting that fungus too. I know this sounds really weird, and when I read this stuff, I thought this is like science fiction stuff, but all of the studies have shown that this is actually what happens in the real world, in native stands of plants and also in the garden, that the plants just start attracting this fungus.
As long as we don't water too much, and that will deter.
Well, yeah, I won't say for sure that watering is a bad thing for the fungus, but fertilizers, especially those high in phosphate, and fungicides are really bad for the hyphal net.
Okay.
It sounds like something out of the X-Files, the hyphal net.
It does.
But it actually really does exist. It exists in the wild, in any stand of plants that are mycorrhizal, and most plants actually are. There are not very many that are not.
That are not what was that?
Mycorrhizal.
Oh, okay. Meaning have that they are open or able to have that relationship with the mycorrhizae.
They don't host that fungus on there.
Okay. And does that mean that they necessarily have it already, or some plants that could benefit from it, might they be void of it?
Well, buffalo grass and blue gramma are weakly mycorrhizal plants, and therefore, in my view, no addition of mycorrhizae is going to help.
Mm-hmm.
They would rather have fertilizer, which I suppose they get from buffalo poop in the wild,
uh-huh,
and things like that. Or they just simply don't need it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, some plants just don't seem to need that that relationship. But I go with the idea that what nature has in mind is probably the best thing for that
mm-hmm,
that soil. So,
right.
In other words, I would flatly contradict people who say that amending soils and ensuring the health of the soil, which is important in vegetable gardening, is at all important in dryland gardening. It's just the opposite. The health of the soil means that you basically leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that's of concern is improving the soil structure if it's heavy clay.
And again, we do that by adding different sizes of gravel.
That's the way, if I were moving to a new house and I had the sort of stuff that I had here in front where I had to dig with a pick, and I have this trowel, it's a Yoho, it's made in Ohio, and it's this long-handled trowel with a really sharp pointed blade, I can dig in it with that. And with my army entrenching tool, if I had that soil again, well, I would weigh the cost. I might just go out and buy a whole bunch of sandy loam and pile it on top, or I would dig it up and put in a whole bunch of gravel, because gravel doesn't decompose.
Mm-hmm.
Organic matter decomposes. If you put in organic matter next month into a garden, it's not going to be there next year. It'll be gone. And the places in my front yard where I added organic matter years ago were rock hard in 5 years.
So what about the theory that a lot of people apply? I know some nurseries tell people to top dress with organic matter around the surface of the plants each fall so it can work its way in, and that seems like a more reasonable approach anyway than the botanic gardens you were describing where they dig the plants up each year.
Yeah, well, I do that top dressing in the parts of the garden where I would not call dry land.
Mm-hmm.
But top dressing in my front yard where there are existing mature native plants is of no benefit to the plants at all. None of those plants evolved in the presence of earthworms. And so it's of no benefit. Colorado does not have any native earthworms, and that's an entirely foreign relationship between native dryland plants and earthworms. But I would also add that a lot of plants do create leaf litter that seems to be important with the mycorrhizal association, like the leaf litter from oaks seems to be really important to the health of the oaks because it has some sort of mysterious relationship with not only the health of the oak, but its ability to maintain this mysterious fungal relationship. So, I mean, if you think about it, how many places in the desert would have a lot of leaf litter and organic matter in them? There's not a lot of trees, so you don't have very much organic matter coming in there. But for regular gardening, sure, why not? I mean, that's, as Graham Stuart Thomas said, that's nature's way on the soil and not in it.
Mm. So when you say regular gardening, basically that's a method, adding organic matter to our soil here in the interior west is a method that allows us to grow plants that are from other parts of the world because we're changing our soil. But it's just going to be a lot more work. It's not like dry land gardening where we're working with what nature has given us.
Oh, it's a huge amount of work. It's a massive amount of work because if you add organic matter to clay soil, it's, as I said before, it's going to be gone within a year. So it really is of no benefit unless you're committed. If you have a staff of gardeners like the Royal Botanic Garden does that can add organic matter, lift all your roses and things like that, and constantly add organic matter, then that's fine. But otherwise, the only alternative that you have, the only practical alternative in this really labor-intensive gardening is to put it on top of the soil and let the worms do their work. But in dryland gardening, we don't care about that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of ignore that. Ignore all of that stuff because it's created, the garden is created to function on its own.
And I read something. Go ahead.
Uh-huh. In my view, that's the only type of gardening that can be called sustainable.
Mm. Yeah, I like that.
The only thing that I do is go out and prune. Well, I sort of prune. But I don't do anything else. And it, people would say, well, you don't weed either. I can tell that. But it's just me, so the weeds aren't so bad.
Will you tell us your definition of sustainable, Bob?
Yeah, it's that it's a garden that requires no input from the gardener.
Mm-hmm. So it sustains itself.
So it will sustain itself indefinitely. It requires no. Well, yeah, let me back up there a minute, because if you have a drought where you have 0 inches in a whole year, you might actually have to water, but those are really unusual circumstances. You know, that's like saying, well, you know, if a plane crashed in your garden, you might lose everything. Yeah, if you have a drought that has 0 inches, dryland plants in the wild die of drought all the time. The Copiapoa cactus in Chile are dying of drought right now as we speak. So dryland plants can die of drought just as easily as others can. But to me, sustainable means that you're not relying on things like treated drinking water for the garden, or purchased or even composted organic matter or fertilizers or anything like that. You have a garden that simply sustains itself mm-hmm. with minimal work from the gardener.
Sounds good to me.
Well, there are some drawbacks to this, and I mean it's not all entirely rosy, because if you do have a serious drought, the garden and the 1st of August is not going to look so great, but it will come back next year and be essentially the same as it was before.
And you could always add a little water to help your plants along, and it's not like it would hurt them in a dryland garden. Is that right?
Dryland plants, all dryland plants native to areas west of the Cascades and the Sierra Nevada can take as much water as you can give them.
Do you mean
during their growing season?
Do you mean east of the Cascades?
Did I say west?
Yeah.
East of the Cascades. Okay. Here. Because the west of the Cascades, they have that, and the Sierra Nevada, they have that long summer dry period. Mm-hmm. But all of the dryland plants native east of there have their growing season during the spring, summer, or autumn, and they can take any amount of water that nature or you gives them, so long as the oxygen is not driven out of the soil.
Great. So that leads me to a question I had about something I saw that you had written at one point that says that too much organic matter combined with lots of watering results in anaerobic conditions and denitrification.
Yeah, denitrification. It does. The organic matter consumes that nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the snow peas and things like that come in. But, yeah, you can get anaerobic soil conditions from too much, well, waterlogged soil where there is no oxygen.
Organic matter or not.
And
right.
Organic matter or not.
Yeah.
Okay, the plants need oxygen in the soil. There are obviously some exceptions, like swamp plants and things like that, that grow in pure mud, but they need oxygen in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So denitrification is a funny thing. I forget what the actual chemical process is, but organic matter can withdraw the nitrogen from the soil, and I believe it can happen fairly rapidly. But again, a crop of peas will put that right back into the soil.
Great.
And that, I would direct that more at regular type gardening than dryland gardening, because I don't really care so much about all of that soil component stuff. I mean, if there's poisons of some sort in the soil, that's a different story, but or too many salts. But I have never understood why people say you add organic matter to aerate the soil and at the same time it holds water. How can that be? How can it do two things at once? How can it aerate the soil and at the same time hold water?
Hmm.
So I tried it for a while, as I say, and then I just thought, the heck with this. I just don't do it.
Mm-hmm. And if someone did have this condition going on where they had worked diligently to add organic matter to the soil as is recommended by many, you know, institutions, and then they water the soil a lot to keep it moist enough because of all that organic matter evaporation happens much more quickly, if they are creating the anaerobic condition and nitrogen is being lost, they would know because chlorosis shows up, right? Or how
and plant death. And plant death. It is important, though, to restate the fact that organic matter will just simply disappear in the soil within a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why vegetable gardeners have to keep adding it every year.
Mm-hmm.
The main purpose of organic matter and having a friable soil doesn't really have anything to do with aeration or anything like that, so much as it does allowing the roots to move easily through the soil. Because most vegetables and most woodland plants have really fine feeder roots, and they need to be able to move through that soil in order to find the nutrients. And so that's where somehow or other it's lost in translation, this difference between vegetable gardening and dryland gardening. There's no drought-tolerant plants in the world that grow in soils that have organic matter in them.
Hmm. Will you say
so
that again?
Why would you translate that, that the vegetable gardening ethos, if you want to call it that, to dryland gardening? They're two totally different activities.
You said no dryland plants in the world grow in soils with organic matter. Is that what you said?
Absolutely none. No,
wow.
They are all native to soils that have extremely low to no organic content. Some of them in pure mineral soils.
And we had...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we had Panayoti Kalaidis talking to us a couple weeks ago about STEP. And so when you say no dryland plants in the world, could you tie that in for us? Does that address other STEP regions of the world? Is that a characteristic?
Sure, I would say. For one thing, the STEP is more of a watered climate than a desert climate. But steppe is not associated with things like trees, for example. And trees are the primary agent of organic matter, leaves falling on the ground. So, yeah, the steppe soils are generally not what you would call like chocolate cake type soils. They're rich in nutrients for farming and things like that, but they're not the chocolate cake soil that people associate with like woodlands and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the plants that come from the steppe are not necessarily what the plants that would be able to tolerate drought in my garden. Most of them are, but a lot of them are not. That sounds like kind of a contradiction. But.
And where do the plants come from in your garden? If
here?
Not step.
Around here? The Intermountain West, Utah, Nevada, northern Arizona, northern New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Places where the seasonal precipitation is the same.
Mm-hmm.
I want to emphasize this seasonal business because people think, well, you know, Denver gets 16 inches of rain I only get about 12. And so other regions that have the same amount of rain are going to have plants that we can grow here without water. But a place like, let's say, Downey, California, a suburb of Los Angeles, gets 16 inches of rain a year too. But the average precipitation in July in Downey is zero. So it's seasonal precipitation that matters.
Great. So when during the season comes is what you mean, the seasonal pattern.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That is the most critical factor. Mm-hmm. So, for example, getting back to the step business, one of the things that is a major component of the dry land garden is bulbs, because most of them bloom at the time of year when we get the most amount of precipitation, springtime. So Denver can grow the widest variety of temperate climate bulbs of any location anywhere, because our climate is so conducive to growing these bulbs. Dwarf iris, tulips, you name it. Things like that are perfectly adaptable because they come from a similar climate, like climates like Central Asia and Turkey and places like that.
Mm-hmm. Must make the Denver Botanic Gardens pretty amazing about now.
It's almost always amazing.
Yeah, that's true.
It's even amazing in the wintertime. And we do actually have some plants that, not dryland plants, that bloom in the wintertime for us here. But really have to emphasize this seasonal precipitation business. It is so much more important than annual precipitation. For example, plants that are adapted to the monsoon in southern New Mexico, southern Arizona, and northern Mexico will require watering here. Colorado does not have a monsoon. There is no monsoonal flora in Colorado. There's a monsoonal flora in the areas that I just described, West Texas included, but not here. So if we start introducing plants from there, which there's a lot of plants in the trade, that they're going to require extra precipitation here. And things like that are important to remember when you're introducing plants. When do they get their moisture? If it's, well, for example, if it's in the wintertime with rain, they're not going to survive here at all, because our climate doesn't feature that. It doesn't rain. I've seen rain in Denver in the wintertime maybe twice in 51 years. Hmm. But the soil is frozen, and so there's no growing period for plants in general in the wintertime here. And the same thing with September. If plants are highly dependent on rainfall in September, that's one of the driest months of the year in my garden. So knowing where a plant comes from is extremely important in having success in the dryland garden.
So it's sounding like there are some advantages to dryland gardening, of course, because as we discussed, they're more sustainable, less work in the long run. But it sounds like it's not necessarily the quote-unquote easy way out. There's all this research you have to do in advance to know about each and every plant that you're planting there. You have to be very patient because, like you said, your plants, some of your shrubs didn't get to maturity until 25 years after you planted them. You double dig. How do you think people can decide if they want to do this, or is it practical for the average gardener? Perhaps they just start with a small bed and see how it goes. What do you recommend, Bob?
Well, I have a lot of things to say about that, but one of the things that I can say, and this makes me sound hugely egotistical and monomaniacal and all this stuff, but I went to a nursery seminar in 2003 after the horrific drought of 2002, And the question was, what are you going to do differently now that you've gone through this drought of 2002? And they asked all these people, you know, what they were going to do differently, and there were all these explanations. Then they came to me, and I said, nothing. I lost some plants, but I expected to lose some plants. And I think that's the biggest difference, is they talk about, you know, well, our summer is going to be really dry and stuff. And I just think, okay, well, whatever. You know, I mean, the front garden survived, as I said before, on less than 7/10 of an inch of rain last year. So, well, I guess, yeah, there's a certain smugness in this approach, but it's a lifestyle for the gardener that it drought. We garden for drought, with drought, and when it comes, and we just say, well, you know, it's really dry here, and then think about something else.
Yeah, I think there was something in your High and Dry book to the effect of, if you employ these methods, there can be a drought, and looking out in your garden, you might not even know the difference. You might not know there's a drought or not.
That's generally true, that you don't. There are some native dryland shrubs, especially, that are drought deciduous. And also the Siberian pea tree, Carragona arborescens, that you see planted around here, that's drought deciduous. It drops its leaves in July, and it has, for about the last three or four summers, except even last year when we had so much rain, it finally dropped its leaves in August. Then they just sit there leafless. Now, the other thing that I was going to say about this is that you have to be willing to accept that. If you don't like the look of shrubs that drop their leaves in the summertime, then this is going to be a difficult thing for you. If you don't like the fact that your garden is really crispy at the middle of August or whenever it's been dry for 4 or 5 weeks, then this is going to be a difficult thing. And to me, I think it's exhilarating. It's just like something, it just says summer to me. And I personally, and I can only reiterate this personal preference, I think a dry garden verging on the edge of crispiness is a lot more evocative and interesting than a garden where the lawn is soaking wet and bright green after weeks of drought.
It sounds like your method is embracing the realities of the West.
Well, it's partly reality. It's also a just kind of a different way of kind of feeling and living gardening. If I lived in California in a place that had 6 months of summer dry, I would grow native shrubs and things like that that went dormant in the summertime and looked at all these leafless plants. They don't all get leafless, but a lot of them get leafless, and just think, wow, you know, this is the way it really is. And yeah, it's a wrench, and I freely admit that I still cling to a lot of traditional gardening things. I still like the rhododendrons. Like I said, I still have some roses, and I have my alpine plants in troughs and things like that that I have to water and baby and things. But as time goes by, I have tried to gradually change most of the garden over to native plants. I planted a whole bunch of mountain mahoganies out in the backyard. I think last year, the Circle Carpus montanus, the native one, I can stand out on my second-story bedroom window with binoculars, and I can see a million of them growing along the hogbacks. And somebody said, well, why would you want that thing? And I said, because I like it. It's got beautiful silver bark in the wintertime, and it is so evocative of the place where I live.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas rhododendrons, you know, that's a totally discordant note, even in my garden.
Mm-hmm.
So I do kind of look on them with shame sometimes. You know, say, why do you grow these? But the only reason that I say that about rhododendrons is that I don't want to come across as a person who is really saying this is the way to garden. There's nothing wrong with growing other things. And if you bought a new house and you wanted to have part of your garden dry land, part of it woodland, part of it this, part of it that, that's okay by me.
That's,
you know, whatever a person wants to do should be what they do. You know, you should follow your bliss as far as gardening is concerned. But one of mine just happens to be dry land gardening.
Well, I think it's
so
great. Go ahead.
I'm not a fanatic about it.
Yeah, I think people who are not fanatics usually are happier people from what I've seen. That's my personal opinion.
I used to go along, you know, back in the late 80s and early 90s, and I'd drive along and I'd see Kentucky bluegrass on berms. And I was like, and I just thought, well, what difference does it make? You know, when the drought comes, I am going to be, just here and looking at my garden, and they're going to be the ones who are complaining.
Right.
So that's the way it is. And there's no real benefit in your life to going around getting angry about things like that that other people do.
Doesn't really help.
Yeah, I just concentrate on what I want to do, and I still do feel guilty about my rhododendrons and some other things, you know, that I grow. I have a bamboo that's very unhappy. Couple of witch hazels, and a few other plants that I know really would be better off someplace else, but I baby them and talk to them and things like that.
I'd like to highlight. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, but if I found cool native plants that I've been looking for a long, long time, out those things would go.
Yeah, and I'd kind of like to highlight this whole notion that you're talking about, and then I have one other question, and I think we're going to wrap up. But the thing I want to highlight is that we don't, in my opinion, as a designer and someone who helps people to plan their properties and how they're going to use their space, I don't think we need to be purists. You know, if dry land gardening sounds interesting to you out there, those of you who are listening, you can try it without having to make this huge black and white decision of all or nothing. And I've often helped to guide homeowners to realize that maybe that side stretch of the yard that no one sees very much would be a perfect place to try something like dry land gardening, especially if you're nervous about how it's going to look, about your drought deciduous shrubs being naked in the summer. If that notion kind of bothers you or you aren't sure how you'll respond to it, the side yard or wherever in your space you don't see very much, behind the shed or something, could be a terrific place to experiment and try it out, and maybe you'll realize that you do really enjoy it, and then you'll want to bring it more closer to your view and where you'll see it more and embrace it. But what a great method to put kind of in the back 40, because it won't need that much of your time and your care and your input every single day or even week. So I think that's one great way that we can look at what we've learned today from Bob. And then, Bob, the last question I had, I wanted to ask you, because I think probably some folks are wondering about this. In early on in our talk, when you said it did take 25 years for some of your shrubs to mature, I know, well, maturing is different, of course, than establishing. And I know that around here in southwestern Colorado, what we were told often is that it can take up to 3 years for a plant to get established. Now, is that amount of time much different in a dryland garden? Is it a lot more than the 3 years for establishment?
I think it depends on the plant. I think that what you just said about 3 years to establish is something that can't be reiterated strongly enough. If you take a thing like a blue spruce, you plant that plant in the ground and you don't loosen the roots, you come back 3 years later, and I'll bet you anything you can pull that thing right up out of the ground, root ball and all. And that's true of almost any tree or shrub. And even if you do, in some cases, like with oaks, the gamble oak and things like that, it can be 4 or 5 years before they establish. It just depends on the specific situation. But I would never suggest watering any plants for just 1 year. I would just gradually decrease that watering program. And I'd say, no, I don't really notice any difference between the two types of gardening, dryland or any other type. I found that most plants take a long time to establish from containers. Now that you can't get field dug bare root trees and shrubs, which is good and bad, and all you have is containerized plants, which have good and bad to them, it's important to remember that root ball needs to be eliminated from the plant. And when that's probably not the right choice of words, but plants don't have root balls in real life. And so it's really important to make sure that those roots are loosened so that they can grow out of that root ball into the surrounding soil. It doesn't matter what kind of soil you have, but into the surrounding soil. So just to get back to the rhododendrons for a minute, you know, I just said, well, all I talked about was rhododendrons the whole time.
I'm starting to think that, Bob.
I got this when I got rhododendrons from this mail order nursery. The first thing that they said was, rip apart those roots. That, you know, don't be shy. Really rip them apart. You know, like take a knife and score that root ball 4 or 5 times, or just take a fork, just a kind of fork you eat with, and just pull those roots apart. And most nurseries don't say that, but this rhododendron nursery did. So that's why I went back to that. It's so important to do that. And if you have a plant that's been in your garden for 3 or 4 years that is now dead, I'll bet you that if you pulled it out, that root ball would come out. It never established. Now, some plants, like blue spruce, can grow in that root ball indefinitely. Mm-hmm. You want to know why?
Yes, of course.
This is very interesting. Okay. This is just general for all plants. The nursery industry started losing a lot of plants grown in containers sitting on the ground. They did research and discovered that the roots of plants are less hardy than the tops. The hardiness begins with the tops of plants, and it goes down. The closer it gets to the soil, the less hardy the plant. The reason why plants survive is because the soil temperature itself is much warmer than the air temperature. It takes much longer for soil to get cold than it does for the air to get cold. So if you take something like the saucer magnolia, Magnolia soulangeana, that's planted all over Denver, those roots are only hardy to 23 degrees. That's 23 above. Tells you right there that the soil in which these are planted all over Denver does not get to 23 degrees. But a blue spruce, those roots are hardy to at least 100 below zero. Yeah, so they can sit possibly even colder than that. So they can sit in that soil for years and not be established.
Mm.
So just because you look at them and you look out there and you think, huh, you know, well, I didn't follow his advice and I didn't loosen the root ball and those plants are still fine 4 years later, I'll bet you anything you could just pull them right up out of the root, out of the ground with the root ball, because the plant can survive that way. And plants that cannot survive in that condition will die. Now, the magnolia just happens to be one that is very sensitive to root disturbance, so I wouldn't recommend loosening the roots, and it should only be planted in the springtime. But in general, that's why it looks like everything is fine with plants that don't have their root ball loosened 4 or 5 years later, because their roots can tolerate extreme cold and they can basically sit there in a pot. You can grow blue spruce in a pot outside, leave the pot outside all winter. It doesn't need any watering. It can be frozen stiff. And so it's not telling you, I'm not established. It's just sitting out there in the garden just as though it were in a pot.
Does that mean it's not growing, though, either?
No, it's still growing.
It is, okay.
Because in the case of conifers, they absorb nutrients through their needles as well as through the roots. Mm. So they still grow.
Mm-hmm.
So I could just come back to this, and it is super, especially hyper important with grasses that you buy when that root ball is so constricted to loosen those roots.
Sometimes that's a lot easier said than done. In my experience, I've even soaked things in a bucket of water for a short amount of time as to not drown them, but to try to loosen those roots, and it's almost impossible with some plants.
It is, and what I saw one nursery person do is just take a knife and just cut straight down.
Mm.
Just cut the thing open in four places, like all four points of the compass, just like that, and just cut the thing open. And that way the damaged root ball starts to form new roots. They cut them open with shears or anything like that, but I have a heavy-duty gardening knife that I can do that with.
Mm-hmm.
And I wear gloves and all that safety stuff too, but
mm-hmm.
When it's just nothing but roots, if you don't do that, the chances of you suffering the consequences the next year or the year after with a dead plant are considerable.
So you're better off cutting into many of the roots than not loosening that root mass at all.
Yeah, if that's what you have to do,
mm-hmm.
that's what you have to do.
Right.
Starting from about a quarter from the top of the root ball, just to make a cut about 2 inches. Let's assume it's a 3-gallon plant. A cut about an inch or 2 inches below the top, and then just cutting down about 2 inches deep in four places all around there, and then planting the plant, not with magnolias, but with almost any other plant. Magnolias tend to get a fungus that will on the roots when the roots are damaged.
Mm, okay. And so I'm assuming you're talking 5-gallon or larger. when you're talking
about even little plants. You know, you get a little tiny, a 3 1/4 inch thing that's so totally root bound that it's just nothing but roots. You just cut them.
Okay.
Just cut them like, I can't think of a description, but I've seen lots of nursery people do that too. I saw one person turn the plant upside down and just cut right through the root ball and just kind of splay the two pieces of the root ball open like that and then plant like that.
Well, I'm glad that you're encouraging people, because from anyone else it can be a little scary, I think, to cut into your plant like that, but you definitely know what you're doing, so I appreciate your guidance that way.
Some of the nurseries that tell you to do this say, you know, don't be afraid of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you're going, you know, I mean, obviously you can just get carried away and cut off all the roots, and plants generally don't live with all the roots cut off. But just cutting through them like that with a good, heavy, sharp knife and then planting them that way. Because everybody gets plants that have really dense root balls like that.
Sure. While we're talking sort of about tools, I just want to ask you real quick about the Yoho trowel you mentioned. I'd actually looked
at Yoho
that before.
The Yoho, they're made in Monticello, Iowa.
How do you find them? I looked online.
We had a Ace Hardware in Englewood that used to carry them, A&A Trade and Post.
Okay.
Used to carry them. They have this incredible trowel, and I have hose and everything like that. They're really well-made tools, but the trowel they have is something that I really couldn't live without it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 18 inches long, and it's a heavy-duty blade and then a long wooden handle.
Yeah, that sounds useful.
It comes with tape around the edges of the trowel because they're so sharp.
Oh, right.
And then you can sharpen it. And there's a couple of other places that offer cool tools too that are really good for gardening in awful soil. Way Cool Tools is a place that sells a lot of stuff that has like long blades, so you can really dig deep down in and plant without having to go to some huge effort. I mean, you know, like now when they talk about planting trees, they used to say backfill the soil with organic matter, and now most experts are saying don't do that. You know, just dig a hole a certain size, not too much bigger than the actual root ball, and plant the tree that way. Well, if you have some of these tools that have really long blades, then it's a lot easier to dig down, and you don't look at this prospect with, you know, such alarm.
Definitely. Well,
it's making my back hurt just thinking about digging.
No kidding. Well, Bob, I think that you've helped a lot of us to realize that we can look at our gardens in a whole different way without so much alarm also through the methods you've shared with us. And I just want to thank you so much for being on the call with us today.
Sure.
And
it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, good. Yeah, for us too.